Just outside of Frostburg, Maryland, on a hill adjacent to Route 68, sits a steel structure and a large sign that reads, "Noah's Ark being rebuilt here." I have often wondered about it as I have driven past, so I decided to look it up, and here's what I found. God's Ark of Safety, as it is known, is a non-denominational Christian ministry in Frostburg, Maryland, led by Pastor Richard Green. On Easter of 1976, Green began building a replica of Noah's Ark atop a prominent hillside along what is now Interstate 68, featuring a sign that announces to passing travelers, "Noah's Ark being rebuilt here." Ground was broken for the Ark in September of 1976 with over 3,000 tons of concrete. It was built to biblical proportions, around 450 by 75 by 45 feet, which is about 1.5 football fields long. Pastor Green's main inspiration for building the Ark came from a three-part dream highlighting Noah's Ark and his vision of salvation for the people of this earth. The vision began in the spring of 74. The vision was to buy 3 acres of land from the farmer who owned it and build the Ark. The 3 acres of land would not be enough to build the ark, so he was told by God to not ask the farmer to buy more land, but instead ask that the farmer give it to him. The pastor currently owns the 4 acres where the structure still stands, along with the church as well. Pastor Green claims that the land itself has curative and restorative powers. It took the pastor and the church 15 years to save up $200,000 to start the project. The structure is still just a frame, but the incomplete ark has drawn attention from foreign film crews and national publications, and Pastor Green has promoted the ministry on worldwide tours, his own radio and television show, and the 700 Club. He has been to 32 countries around the world, spreading the word of God and his vision for him to build an ark on the land and to potentially raise money and accept donations for that vision. The story of the rebuilding of the Ark has been spread all across the world, and reporters and visitors have come from as far as China to witness what is taking place. It has been in People magazine, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, and many other prominent publications. The completed Ark will purportedly hold anywhere from 1,500 to 1,700 people, with a gymnasium and a theater. The Ark will also contain a Christian grade school, high school, and Bible college. Pastor Green believes that the Ark today would require $30 to $50 million to complete, and the church is still receiving donations, which are funneled into a building fund with the hopes of one day completing the Frostburg Ark. Of course, that Ark in Frostburg has been overshadowed in recent months by the work of one Ken Ham. He is the man behind the $102 million Ark replica that was recently completed and opened to the public in northern Kentucky. Since it opened in early July, thousands of people have flocked to see it. According to their website, a one-day pass will set you back $40, or you could opt for the unlimited seven-day combo pass for a mere $99. It is quite a sight to behold, evidently, complete with an animatronic Noah, as well as lifelike models of some of the creatures that came on board two by two, such as bears, short-necked giraffes, and, of course, juvenile Tyrannosaurus rexes. The biblical story of Noah and his ark has clearly fascinated people for generations. It has, in many ways, taken on a life of its own, well known beyond the bounds of Judaism and Christianity. Of course, since Noah's story is so well known, especially in Judeo-Christian traditions, many people could retell the story without even rereading it, at least able to hit the highlights. God tells Noah to build an ark because he's going to flood the world to rid it of the unrighteous. People laugh at Noah, but he does it anyway. He puts 2 of every kind of animal on the ark. Rain begins to fall for 40 days and 40 nights, flooding the world. Noah and his family are the only people spared. Eventually, he sends out birds that come back with evidence of dry land. The waters recede. Everyone gets off the ark. God puts a rainbow in the sky, promising never to flood the earth again. End of the story. Of course, that isn't where Noah's story ends. Between the rainbow in the sky and the closing verses that tell us that Noah lived for an additional 350 years, totaling 950 years of life, we find a strange story that sheds some light on Noah and his slightly dysfunctional family. Picking up in Genesis chapter 9, verse 20, Noah, a man of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard. He drank some of the wine and became drunk, and he lay uncovered, that is, naked, in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both of their shoulders, and walked backwards and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, lowest of slaves he shall be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed by the Lord my God be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave. May God make space for Japheth, and let him live in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his slave." Didn't remember that part of the story, did you? Or maybe you did, but you'd forgotten. What we find in Noah in these verses is a trend that started in the very first people, Adam and Eve, and continues throughout the biblical witness. That theme, of course, is the tendency of our God to work through imperfect, often very broken people. The Noah that we've always heard about was fiercely faithful, irrepressibly independent, and relentlessly resolute. Noah was the model of great faith. Very few ever refer to Noah's losing battle with wine. Maybe being strong and faithful has its downside. Maybe for flood survivors, life is more complicated than we would like to think. And maybe even Noah could have bouts of depression and loneliness. But why should we be surprised? It turns out all of the biblical characters were a complex mix of strengths and weaknesses. David and Abraham, Lot and Saul, Solomon, Rahab, and Sarah were God-loving, courageous, brilliant, fearless, loyal, passionate, committed, holy men and women who also happened to be murderers, adulterers, and liars. They were men and women who could be gentle and holy, defenders of the faith one minute, and insecure, mentally unstable, unbelieving, shrewd, lying, grudge-holding tyrants the next. Of course, the New Testament characters weren't much better. Look at who Jesus hung out with. Prostitutes and tax collectors, adulterers, mental cases, penniless riffraff, and losers of all kinds. His disciples were hardly models of saintliness. They were committed to him, were ready to follow him anywhere, with one notable exception. But they were also troubled by infighting, always jockeying for position, suspicious of each other, accusatory, impulsive, selfish, lazy, and at times disloyal. Most of the time, they did not understand what Jesus was talking about. And when he died, they had no clue what to do next. And so once again, we are reminded of how often God chooses to use the least likely people to accomplish God's will. Jesus even admitted as much when he was recruiting his disciples. When the scribes and Pharisees saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" When Jesus heard this, he said to them, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I have come to call not the righteous, but sinners." And that includes people like Noah and Moses and Matthew and Paul. And it also includes you and me. For who sins more than we do? Who is more broken than you? Or me, for that matter? It is some of the best of the good news of the gospel that Jesus Christ came to save sinners. And it is so good to be reminded. Back in June, Ashley and I volunteered, as we do each summer, to lead a week of summer camp. Each year, the camp chooses a new theme, and each day of the week, a different biblical story on which to focus. This summer, the theme is Carry the Torch, and the biblical story for Tuesday was the story of Rahab. If you're not familiar with Rahab's story, then you really should read the second chapter of Joshua. The long and the short of it is that Rahab was a prostitute living in Jericho at the time that God had commanded Joshua to attack and to take that city. Joshua had sent two spies into the city to scout it out, and when they arrived in the city, Rahab hid them and then helped them escape capture. For her assistance, she and her family were spared when the Israelites attacked and ultimately conquered Jericho. It is a fascinating and captivating story, to be sure, but as Ashley and I found out, a little tricky to explain to elementary school students. How do you explain what a prostitute is to a third grader? Well, it turns out you don't. At least we didn't. What we did do was point out that Rahab was considered less than, a castaway by the other people in the city. But still, God chose to use her to make something incredible happen. God chose to use a sinner to accomplish God's will. And that is a lesson that everyone needs to hear. Third graders and octogenarians alike. Anne Lamott, an incredible Christian author, describes perfectly what happens when Jesus pursues us, even sinners like us. In her book, Traveling Mercies, Anne recounts her own incredible conversion to Jesus. Things were not going well in her life. She was addicted to cocaine and alcohol, involved in an affair that produced a child whom she aborted, helplessly watching her best friend die of cancer. During this time, Anne visited a small church periodically. She would sit in the back to listen to the singing, and then she would leave before the sermon. During the week of her abortion, she spiraled downward. Disgusted with herself, she drowned her sorrows in alcohol and in drugs. She had been bleeding for many hours from the abortion and finally fell into bed, shaky and sad, smoked a cigarette, and turned off the light. She writes, "After a while, as I lay there, I became aware of someone with me, hunkered down in the corner, and I just assumed it was my father, whose presence I had felt over the years when I was frightened and alone. The feeling was so strong that I actually turned on the light for a moment to make sure no one was there. And of course, there wasn't. But after a while, in the dark again, I knew beyond any doubt that it was Jesus. I felt him as surely as I feel my dog lying nearby as I write this. And I was appalled. I thought about what everyone would think of me if I became a Christian. And it seemed an utterly impossible thing that simply could not be allowed to happen. I turned to the wall and said out loud, I would rather die. I felt him just sitting there on his haunches in the corner of my sleeping loft, watching me with patience and love. And I squinched my eyes shut, but that didn't help, because that's not what I was seeing him with. Finally, I fell asleep, and in the morning he was gone. This experience spooked me badly, but I thought it was just an apparition born of fear and self-loathing and booze and loss of blood. But then everywhere I went, I had the feeling that a little cat was following me, wanting me to reach down and pick it up, wanting me to open the door and to let it in. But I knew what would happen. You let that cat in one time, give it a little milk, and then it stays forever. And 1 week later, when I went back to church, I was so hungover that I couldn't stand up for the songs. And this time I stayed for the sermon, which I thought was so ridiculous. Like someone trying to convince me of the existence of extraterrestrials. But the last song was so deep and raw and pure that I could not escape. It was as if the people were singing in between the notes, weeping and joyful at the same time. And I felt their voices, or something, was rocking me in its bosom, holding me like a scared child. And I opened up to that feeling, and it washed over me. I began to cry and left before the benediction, and I raced home, and I felt the little cat running along at my heels. And I walked down the dock past dozens of potted flowers under a sky as blue as one of God's own dreams. And I opened the door to my houseboat, and I stood there a minute. And then I hung my head, and I said, I quit. I took a long, deep breath and said out loud, all right, you can come in. So this was my moment, my beautiful moment of conversion. Judging from what she shares about herself, one might think that Anne Lamott is the most improbable candidate for conversion. And God's work, we can imagine until, of course, we consider our own candidacy. She seems hopelessly messed up until we remember the mess of our own lives. And if we're honest, we can recognize that little cat running along at her heels. For it's the same cat that's been hounding us all along as well. No matter how hard we've tried, we've never been able to shake him. And we won't be able to shake him either. So we might as well give up, as Anne did, and let the cat in. And then we can decide what we're going to do with that not-so-little Jesus who, running wild in our hearts, will wreak havoc in our souls, sinners even that we are. Sure, Noah wasn't perfect. He got drunk, and he laid around naked, and then he cursed his son just because he happened to walk past. But you know what? I'm not perfect either. And neither are you. And the crazy thing is, we are just the kind of people who Jesus came for, who Jesus still comes for, who God chooses to do incredible things on God's behalf. It's always a good reminder that if and when we start to feel like we or others